Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter at www.churchleadership.com/leading ideas. What can church leaders learn from Moses and others about leading? In this episode, Director Douglas Poe discusses biblical leadership with thought leader Dr. Denise Domkowski Hopkins, the Woodrow W. and Mildred B. Miller Professor of Biblical Theology at Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C.
Welcome to Leading Ideas Talks, a podcast featuring thought leaders and innovative practitioners. I'm Douglas Poe, the director of the Lewis Center, and your host for this talk. Joining me is Dr. Denise Domkowski Hopkins, the Woodrow W. and Mildred B. Miller Professor of Biblical Theology at Wesley Theological Seminary. Our focus for this podcast is biblical leadership. Denise, I really appreciate you joining us today and taking this opportunity to talk about biblical leadership, because this topic is so important, particularly to many of the individuals who are in congregations. I want to begin by asking you, what are some of the common assumptions pastors make about biblical leadership that often need nuancing?
Hi, Doug. It's great to be here. I very much enjoyed teaching this course and encountering the pastors in Images of Biblical Leadership. And I think the persistent challenge that I find with every class of pastors is their tendency to idealize the figures that we are studying. They put Moses on a pedestal. They put Paul on a pedestal. And they set themselves up for failure if they do not perform in the ways that Moses and Paul and the psalmists perform. And that can be very frustrating for them.
So Denise, to follow up with that, do you think they do that because Moses and Paul are in the Bible, or do you think they do that because they sort of create a mythology around these figures in their own minds?
Well, I think those two points are connected, Doug. Certainly because they're in the Bible is rarefied air. The Bible is their canon, their guide for life. But I think in their minds, probably from Sunday school and other well-meaning pastors, they've participated in the mythology of these figures. King David is the beloved of God. That's a pretty tough act to follow.
Yes.
And when I point out the flaws and the challenges in David's life, the ideal that they've created suddenly doesn't seem so ideal anymore. And I think that's a very important learning. And what happens is that they get to share their own stories of challenges by relating to these biblical figures and their challenges. And sometimes there are tears in the classroom, male and female tears, because they've held themselves to these ideal standards for so long. And I say, you don't have to do that anymore. And the warrant for that is these figures in the Bible.
Thank you. I think that's really helpful. I want to, you've talked a little bit about Moses. I want to dig into Moses a little bit more directly. People often lift Moses up as sort of an exemplary leader. Moses is certainly probably more complicated often than what we imagine. How would you characterize Moses' leadership?
I love Moses. I love the book we use to study Moses by Norman Cohen, who is a Jewish theologian. His book's entitled Moses and the Journey to Leadership. Because Moses lifts up an aspect of leadership that I think is crucial to any good leader. And that is, Moses exhibits the quality of chutzpah. And chutzpah in Jewish tradition is basically boldness with regard to God for the sake of justice and community. more colloquial way of putting this would be to say, chutzpah is getting in God's face over issues that matter in the community. So, for example, Moses argues with God, blames God. When the taskmasters increase the slaves' burden in Egypt by saying, you want to go away for 3 days and worship God? Oh, no, you're not doing that. In fact, now you will continue to meet your brick quota, but now you must gather your own straw in order to make the bricks, whereas before we had provided it. The slaves and their overseers, of course, complain to Moses, and then Moses complains to God and says, you haven't done a thing to help these people. In fact, you've made it worse. And most leaders, I find, come into class and tiptoe around their relationship with God and repress the kind of anger and questioning they feel in terms of what they encounter in their ministry. And they are very hesitant to wrestle with God over what's happening with them in the ministry setting. Moses is the example of, let's wrestle, God. Moses is willing to take God on, meet God face to face. And God actually encourages Moses to do that. It starts with Moses' call in Exodus 3. Moses objects 5 times, and God meets the objection every time with reassurance and by equipping Moses with something he will need in his leadership. So the template for the relationship between God and Moses is set in that call story with all of its objections. It says very clearly, Moses is not called to be God's puppet. Moses is called to be God's partner in the liberation of the Israelite slaves. And then again, in Genesis 32, in the golden calf story, Moses is gone up on the mountain receiving the Ten Commandments from God for too long, and the people begin to worry. They are actually terrified that they've lost their leader upon whom they've come to depend so totally. And of course, Aaron and the people fashion this golden calf, which I think is a misinterpreted story. But when Moses comes down, God actually says to Moses, leave me alone so that my anger can burn against this rebellious people. And it's almost as if God is inviting Moses to challenge God about any punishment that God would give. Moses is, in effect, taking the people's side and, for the sake of justice, is reminding God, look at what they've been through. They were worried I wasn't coming back. This was their stopgap for security, for some notion of leadership in their lives. Do you really want to wipe them all out? And God changes God's mind. So it's an extraordinary example of this tussling, wrestling relationship that I think so many Christian pastors have not even considered as a possibility, because Christianity so often emphasizes obedience and a humility that would argue against any showing of chutzpah. So I love these stories in Moses' life because they illustrate the importance of chutzpah, which also Abraham showed in arguing with God over the fate of Sodom. The lament psalmists show in Psalm 44, the community asks, wake up, God, why are you asleep? It basically accuses God of sleeping on the job in the Babylonian exile. That is an honest relationship with God. And I think we cultivate at our peril a relationship that covers over the questions and the doubt. And Moses shows us a different way.
Thank you. That is good. I want to stick with Moses and I pick up on a piece of what you said. And I think this comes out somewhat a little bit when you were talking about Exodus 32. And my question is, what can we learn from Moses about disappointment and unrealistic expectations in leadership? So that it seems like there was obviously disappointment that when they didn't think Moses was coming back, they went this other way. But Moses learns from this, and it seems that it doesn't detract him from what he's called to do. But sometimes I think as leaders in congregations, when we experience disappointment, we do get detracted.
Moses deals with a series of disappointments as he leads the people in the wilderness. And each time he realizes that there's really nothing else he can do but put one foot in front of the other and move on. But I think, again, what enables him to deal with those disappointments is that he can share that disappointment with God. And he does that several times in these stories. He turns to God repeatedly and says, you know, why did you send me at one point? I've only made things worse for these people. So what that points to, I think, is the necessity of pastors being able to share honestly their disappointments with God, and also learn how to package that disappointment in ways that can be inspiring for their congregation. What Moses does often when he is experiencing disappointment is to restate the promises that God has made. So that is a cue that it's very important for the leader to articulate regularly, frequently, and clearly the vision, which hopefully he or she has gotten the whole congregation to buy into. But again, guides along the way come in the form of restating the vision, maybe nuancing it and tweaking it a bit for changed circumstances, but holding that vision up as the light at the end of the tunnel. So it is a kind of two-pronged approach to disappointment. Share it with God, restate the vision, not only for the congregation, but also for yourself as leader. It's a reminder. It functions as a kind of pep talk. This is why I'm bearing this disappointment. It's for the sake of this vision. So then it becomes less about you personally and more about what it is God is having us all do together.
Thank you. That is good. I want to get your thoughts, and I don't know if this is a completely fair question, sort of sticking with Moses, but it's sort of in transition. In churches, there are some individuals who often have to follow sort of a great leader or someone who's been there for a long time. And of course, Joshua finds himself having to follow Moses in terms of leadership. What can we learn from Joshua on how we can do this well? This is sort of a common struggle in terms of transitioning leadership. Are there any lessons we can take away on how to maybe better do these transitions?
Well, it's interesting that you chose Joshua because he's so tainted by his place in the Deuteronomistic history, which is Israel's explanation in Joshua through 2 Kings of how it wound up in exile. He's so tainted by holy war, which is divine, which is violence in God's name, that I don't even discuss him as a leader because I think he's a negative example of leadership. So when I do raise his name, it's almost as a foil. Mm-hmm. He does follow Moses, and he does do some of the same things Moses did as a way of perhaps stressing his continuity with Moses. And the prime example of that is in Joshua 2, he sends spies into the promised land. Moses and Caleb were themselves spies for Moses in the promised land. So he's following in the footsteps of his predecessor, Moses, very clearly. I'm not sure. I would love to have seen what Moses would have done in the Promised Land, but he too might have been co-opted by this whole notion of holy war, which I think is one of the most damaging parts of the entire Bible, particularly when it's taken literally, that God is on our side. So I really hesitate to say that we can learn much that is positive about Joshua.
That makes sense to me. So how would you transition my question then to who would be helpful for us in terms of helping leaders?
Well, I think, again, let's go back to Moses. When I end the unit on Moses, I have the class read his going up to Mount Nebo and looking out at the Promised Land. And then I ask them, if you were to leave your church setting today, what can you point to as accomplishments? What do you feel good about? And I think that is an important step in the whole transition process. For a pastor to let go and make space for the new person to come in, there has to be some kind of an assessment of what it is that pastor has done in that place that the pastor can point to and say, you know, that was well done, my servant. And it may not be huge. It may be something rather modest, but still something important in the life of the congregation. That sets up a space in terms of a psychological space for the new person coming in. If the pastor leaving creates a good space commending the congregation for their work with him or her over these past years, then that allows the new person to come in who should honor what has been done before, at least those good things that have been done before. And then it's incumbent upon the new pastor to articulate his or her own vision, showing what is in continuity with the past, what needs to be addressed in the present, and how the congregation can move into the future. So I think what would be helpful in that space, and this is something I have my pastors do as a post-class assignment, they have to write a church's creation story. And I've taken my cue from Reverend Tom Berlin, who is pastor at Floris United Methodist Church in Virginia. He wrote a wonderful little article for Leading Ideas, which I love. Everyone should be subscribed to Leading Ideas.
Thank you.
And he talked about the church's creation story, and he focused on Deuteronomy 26, which is the bringing of first fruits. And that text has been called by scholars Israel's credo. Israel doesn't really have any creeds, but this comes closest, and it basically begins with a wandering Aramean was my father. So it traces the past history of the people, their presence now in the Promised Land. So it moves from slavery in Egypt to deliverance in the Exodus to entry into the Promised Land, and then talks about the future, about how these first fruits will be brought every year in memory of this. So it's a way for Israel to create a memory that builds continuity with the past into the present and into the future. So important in transition, I believe, is this notion of creation story. And those pastors who are newly coming into a church found that that exercise was extremely helpful to them. It's something they didn't write by themselves, but had to craft in communication with many other people in the congregation. I call them lead sheep. So they are asked to look at older members, younger members, committee chairs, et cetera, the archives of the church, and put together, usually in a video form, this creation story of the church, which hopefully they can use in a liturgy or for new members. But it's a way to kind of take stock of where we've been, where we are, and where we will be going. And every new pastor coming into a new church setting needs to do something like that. Or we get many deacon pastors who are maybe 7 years in a particular appointment. It's time for a recharge, as it were. And so they get their batteries jumped by doing this assignment on the creation story. So Israel doesn't have a figure per se, but certainly has a credo that models what that transition could entail.
That's helpful. Thank you. And I appreciate you moving us from Joshua to talking about it in that manner. I want to be mindful that I have lifted up male examples of leadership. And I want to ask, so that we don't just lift up male examples of leadership, how can we be very intentional about also lifting up female examples of leadership in the biblical text? And how do you incorporate that into what you teach?
That is a wonderful question. And unfortunately, the number of named women is rather small in the entire Bible. In fact, the Dictionary of Women in the Bible has a larger section on unnamed women than it does on named women. But I do hold up several women as leaders. One of them is Miriam, Moses' sister. And there is a delightful midrash, or reading between the lines, in the Jewish commentary on Hebrew Bible called the Talmud on Miriam. It is interesting that as soon as the Israelites cross the Red Sea, Miriam and all the women take up what the English Bible say are tambourines, but the Hebrew is really tofim, they're small hand drums, and they dance and sing, and they proclaim, "Sing to the Lord has triumphed gloriously. The horse and rider, the Lord has thrown into the sea." And so the question is, why did Miriam and the women have with them these tofim, these small hand drums? Didn't Israel have to leave Egypt in a hurry because Pharaoh was out to kill them all because of the plague of the firstborn? Why then did they stop and take these drums with them? And the midrash is that these women saw potential in this moment in their history because God was there. So they were anticipating deliverance, even in the midst of their fleeing for their lives from Egypt, and brought those drums with them so they could celebrate. And so one of the characteristics of leadership would be to anticipate the possibilities inherent in any moment, to be ready to celebrate those moments. I think it's a beautiful vignette, and it lifts up the foresight of these women and their steadfast belief in God's ability to save.
That's a beautiful story. I do. I really like that. That is that is powerful. When you share that, is that helpful? Because I like that image of anticipation. Does that help students to think differently about their own leadership sort of style?
Absolutely, absolutely. Some of them will self-assess as, "Oh, I always tend to see the glass half full." Some of them will confess that they tend to see the glass half empty all of the time. And Miriam is inviting them to see the glass as half full and anticipate that it's going to get even more full. So it comes as a kind of wake-up moment for the students who never ever really thought of it that way. It also allows me to talk about women in Hebrew Bible as those who are, in effect, the local newspapers. We will see, for instance, during the kingship of Saul in the transition to David, how women will greet the warriors on their return from battle. And there's one song recorded where they sing, Saul has slain his thousands, but David has slain his 10,000s. So they are commenting on what has happened for the whole community to hear. So women often show up dancing and singing and playing drums to basically vocalize what is actually going on in community. So in a sense, they're the truth tellers. They're the independent media, I guess we could say today, who are digging below the surface to see what's really going on. And that is a very important leadership characteristic.
Yeah, that is. Thank you. As we get ready to close, I want to end with this question. How can pastors or key lay use the Bible to teach leadership in a way that has integrity, especially when they won't have an opportunity to sit in your class, in many cases, to learn all the wonderful things that you're sharing? So how can they do this knowing that they may have limited resources to do so?
That's such an important question. I wish every church had had a LCD projector and PowerPoint capabilities, and some of them don't. I think the most important thing that a pastor could do in a church setting is to examine the details of a biblical story and not edit out the challenging or the tough parts or the flaws in the characters that are being studied. And in that sense, it's my favorite phrase is, let the Bible do the work for you. I think the pastor's job is to ask the kinds of questions of the group, particularly if you're cultivating a group of lay leaders, about these figures, about Moses, about Paul, about David, that help them to see that these characters are not perfect, that they have some rough edges, and to look very honestly at those rough edges. Paul certainly didn't mince words. He could be very rough. The book we read by Askuf and Cotton on Paul the Passionate Visionary talks about sandpaper. Paul could use some heavy grit sandpaper in certain situations. And one could hold up those situations and say, is that really the model that you want to follow? In other words, not everything these leaders do should be emulated. Some of what they do can be held up as a negative example, as an example of what one should probably not do in a certain situation, because it simply raises people's defenses, all right? So I think just following the biblical story faithfully, getting a couple of commentaries together, not Matthew Henry, please, no, but something much more current to look at the different facets of these characters. David, the beloved of God, did so many things badly. David under the blessing becomes David under the curse with the rape and adultery and of Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah. And everything goes downhill from there. The dysfunction in his family was tremendous. His son rapes his daughter. His other son kills the son who raped his daughter. And David sits back and does nothing. So it's important to see that leaders are not infallible. It's important to see that leaders can make mistakes. And it's also important to see how leaders can inspire. So let the Bible speak in its fullness. Don't edit it. Don't protect people from the challenging parts. And I think that would go a long way toward cultivating good leadership.
Well, Denise, thank you very much. This has been really good, and you have made some wonderful, wonderful points as we've gone through this.
I really enjoyed this, Doug. I want to say again how much I appreciate the Lewis Center for what it is doing. I think it has been a tremendously positive conversation partner for pastors. I use what you publish in my DMEAN classes all the time, so keep it coming, and I thank you for your very visionary leadership.
Leading Ideas Talks has been brought to you by Journey Through the Psalms, an adult Christian study presented by Dr. Denise Domkowski-Hopkins. This 8-session video study is ideal for your congregation's small groups, adult Bible studies, and Sunday school classes. Learn more at churchleadership.com/shop. Leading Ideas Talks is available on iTunes, the Google Play Store, and Stitcher. Subscribe today. Thank you for joining us, and don't forget to subscribe free to Leading Ideas at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.